Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. World, Middle East, Trump says U.S. will guide stranded ships through Strait of Hormuz. The president called the plan, which doesn't involve escorts by U.S. warships, a humanitarian gesture, and said that discussions with Iran continue, by Lara Seligman and Robbie Gramer. President Trump said Sunday that the U.S. would start guiding commercial ships out of the Strait of Hormuz, where they have been trapped by the war between the U.S. and Iran, adding that talks continued with Tehran to find an end to the conflict. Countries from all over the world have asked the United States if we could help free up their ships, which are locked up in the Strait of Hormuz, Trump wrote on Truth Social on Sunday. For the good of Iran, the Middle East, and the United States, we have told these countries that we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways so that they can freely and ably get on with their business. The new effort, which Trump dubbed Project Freedom, is a process through which countries, insurance companies, and shipping organizations can coordinate moving traffic through the strait, according to a senior U.S. official. It doesn't currently involve U.S. Navy warships escorting vessels through the strait, the official said. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has recently deployed naval mines in the strait, posing new dangers for commercial shipping traffic through the waterway, according to the official. Before the conflict, some 20% of the world's oil supply passed through the strait. If there is interference with the process, that will, unfortunately, have to be dealt with forcefully, Trump said in his social media post. The initiative will begin on Monday morning, Middle East time, Trump wrote. He described the move as a humanitarian gesture on behalf of the U.S., Middle Eastern countries, and in particular Iran, without elaborating on what role the Islamic Republic would play. And on to our next story. Exclusive deals GameStop is offering to buy eBay for $56 billion, CEO Ryan Cohen says. Cohen told the Wall Street Journal he wants to make eBay a legit competitor to Amazon, by Lauren Thomas. Chief Executive Ryan Cohen said he was making an unsolicited offer to buy eBay for about $56 billion and saw a path to make the e-commerce company a much bigger competitor to Amazon.com. Cohen told the Wall Street Journal that GameStop has built a roughly 5% stake in eBay and was offering $125 a share in cash and stock, a roughly 20% premium to its closing price on Friday. eBay should be worth and will be worth a lot more money, Cohen said in an interview. I'm thinking about turning eBay into something worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Cohen said he has a commitment letter from TD Bank to provide around $20 billion in debt financing to help make a deal possible. If eBay isn't receptive to the proposal, Cohen said he was prepared to run a proxy fight and take his offer directly to shareholders. The window for shareholders to nominate director candidates at eBay ahead of an annual meeting scheduled for this June has already closed, according to the company's proxy materials. GameStop is expected to make the details of its offer public later Sunday. In the interview, Cohen said putting his video game retailer and eBay under one roof could create huge opportunities to cut costs and improve earnings. The two companies share some sharp overlap already, including a focus on selling collectibles such as trading cards. There is nobody who is more qualified, based on my experience, to run the eBay business, Cohen said, referencing his time at GameStop and previously Chewy, the online pet products marketplace he co-founded. The Wall Street Journal reported Friday evening that GameStop had been building an undisclosed stake in eBay and was preparing an offer. eBay was valued at about $46 billion ahead of the journal's report. Its shares shot up around 12% in after-hours trading on news of Cohen's potential offer. GameStop is a much smaller company than eBay, valued at around $12 billion. That makes pulling off this sort of deal no easy feat. GameStop has around $9 billion in cash on its balance sheet to put toward a deal. It wasn't immediately clear how it would come up with the rest of the money needed for a $56 billion acquisition. It is possible Cohen could tap outside investors such as Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds to back the deal, people familiar with the matter said. Some Wall Street analysts are already skeptical that Cohen could pull off an acquisition. Investors have embraced eBay's focus on collectibles and other niche categories. Why disrupt things? The turnaround is working, Bernstein analysts say about eBay in a note to clients. Cohen built a big stake in GameStop in 2020 and criticized the company for moving too slowly toward e-commerce. He started gaining a cult-like following among retail traders online and proceeded to make a number of other activist bets, including at Bed Bath & Beyond. GameStop gained fame during the meme stock craze of 2021, in which individual traders bid up the retailer's stock. In 2023, the company named Cohen, who was already serving as chairman, as its new CEO. Under Cohen's watch, GameStop has closed hundreds of stores and exited much of its international business. It has pivoted toward higher-margin items such as trading cards, retro games, and consoles that strike a nostalgic chord with shoppers. Cohen has told the Journal in January that he was scouting out big acquisition targets. He said he saw ways to integrate GameStop's bricks-and-mortar stores with eBay's online operations to help scale both companies. The stores could become locations to collect and authenticate items from eBay sellers, for example, he said. He also said he believed eBay should be doing more around live commerce, where brands sell directly to shoppers via real-time video streams. It could be a legit competitor to Amazon, Cohen said about eBay. eBay has already been taking steps to cut costs with a strategy that includes embracing artificial intelligence tools to help streamline its buying and selling processes. In February, the company said it would be culling about 6.5% of its global workforce, or roughly 800 employees. Late last month, eBay reported strong first quarter results and said its gross merchandise volume, or the total value of all paid transactions between users on its marketplace, climbed 18% versus the prior year period. Smaller companies have pulled off much larger deals before. Paramount Skydance earlier this year emerged victorious in a bidding war for Media Warner Brothers Discovery. Charter Communications struck a debt-fueled merger with the much bigger Time Warner Cable in 2015. Cohen also has a potentially massive payday at stake if he can pull it all off. GameStop adjusted Cohen's compensation package at the beginning of the year to give him extra incentive to boost the company's market value and profitability. He stands to make as much as $35 billion in stock if certain criteria are met, including if its market value hits $100 billion, the journal previously reported. I'm going to be as focused on eBay, as personally involved as I have been in the GameStop turnaround for the next few years, Cohen said. A federal housing handout has ended. Foreclosures will follow. A Biden-era program that prevented distressed borrowers from losing their homes has been rolled back, by Carol Ryan. A generous Biden-era subsidy that helped people who fell behind on their mortgage stay in their homes was recently scaled back. A jump in foreclosures is an early sign of the fallout. The number of U.S. homes with foreclosure filings rose 28% in March compared with a year ago, data from Adams shows. Foreclosures are still below 2019 levels, but probably not for long. homeowners with the Federal Housing Administration mortgage who get into financial difficulty can apply for a subsidy, known as a partial claim, to clear any arrears on their mortgage. Some borrowers can also get a loan modification to make their monthly payment more manageable. During the pandemic, the Department of Housing and Urban Development lifted limits on how many times borrowers could receive these partial claims. The only restriction was that the total claims couldn't exceed 30% of the outstanding balance on the mortgage. Many people who used the program were in genuine distress, but others were gaming it. Mark McDonough, a managing partner of consultancy Assume Loans, found instances in publicly available documents of homeowners who repeatedly claimed the subsidy. One buyer, who purchased a $430,000 home in Woburn, Mass. in 2019, has received 5 partial claims totaling $96,000 since 2021. The arrears will eventually have to be settled. They are added to the mortgage balance in a junior lien that is repaid once the loan matures, is refinanced, or the home is sold. However, as the arrears accrue no interest, the homeowner effectively got a $96,000 interest-free loan for the lifetime of the mortgage. This can't happen anymore after the Trump administration tightened the rules. Since last October, borrowers can only apply for one partial claim or loan modification every 2 years. They also have to make 3 consecutive mortgage payments before they qualify for government help to settle any arrears. This is to make sure they are able to pay the loan longer term. Borrowers who can't meet this bar will start to show up in foreclosure numbers. Is a coming wave of forced sales bad news for U.S. home prices? It depends. Distress is high in FHA mortgages, where a lot of first-time buyers and lower-income Americans get their home financing. But these riskier loans make up only about 1/10 of all outstanding mortgages in the U.S. As of March, 11.6% of borrowers were delinquent, according to John Kaminsky, founder of Reverse Engineering Finance, who tracks the performance of 7 million out of the 8 million outstanding FHA loans captured in Ginnie Mae's mortgage-backed securities data. The real number is higher, as some of the most troubled mortgages are taken out of the MBS pool of loans. Kaminsky believes up to half of seriously delinquent FHA borrowers could fail to make the 3 consecutive mortgage payments needed to qualify for help under the new rules, based on conversations he has had with professionals that service the loans. If that happens, he expects around 250,000 people to lose their homes over the next 12 to 18 months, either through a voluntary sale, a foreclosure, or a short sale. The story here is that people have been distressed over the last 5 years, but loss mitigation prevented the natural clearing cycle, says Kaminsky. The flood behind the dam has to be released. Depending on where they bought their house, some seriously delinquent borrowers might get lucky. In parts of the country where home prices are still rising, owners may have built enough accidental equity to let them sell at a price that clears their liabilities. The $430,000 home in Woburn now has more than $500,000 outstanding on the mortgage, including the arrears. The property could probably be sold for $625,000, according to Assume Loans McDonough, as the local housing market is hot. But another property in Lee County, Florida, shows how foreclosures could drag down local values in areas where the housing market is already weak. A new single-family home that was purchased from the home builder D.R. Horton for $394,000 in 2022 went through foreclosure earlier this year after its owner got into difficulty. It is now back on the market for $270,000. That is bad for values in the neighborhood. The owner of a similar size nearby home paid $376,000 earlier this year, Zillow data shows. Foreclosures are going to be painful for people losing their homes and possibly for their neighbors too. And on to our next story. Central banking. Why Jerome Powell decided to stay at the Fed. The departing Fed chair didn't want to remain on the board. He concluded he had no choice. By Nick Tiramos. The Federal Reserve was breaking all the rules. It was April 2020, with pandemic lockdowns producing some of the scariest moments for the U.S. economy in decades. The central bank had just rolled out plans to do things it would never ordinarily do. Lending to mid-sized businesses, purchasing junk bonds, and hoovering up treasury securities at a pace that had never attempted. Federal Chair Jerome Powell was unapologetic. "None of us has the luxury of choosing our challenges," he said in a virtual speech. "Fate and history provide them for us. Our job is to meet the tests we are presented." 6 years later, the same sentiment explains a more personal reckoning. His decision to remain on the Fed's board after his term as chair ends May 15th, the first chair to do so since Mariner Eccles in 1948. Powell had long been counting down the days to retirement. By April, he had concluded reluctantly that the days were no longer his to count. Powell's decision was one he didn't want to make and hoped he could avoid, according to interviews with current and former Fed officials and others who have worked closely with him. At his final news conference last week, Powell said President Trump's legal challenges had crossed a line that threatened to change how the Fed operates. "The things that have happened, really, in the last 3 months have left me no choice," he said. Staying on the board was his bid to ensure the central bank would continue to be able to conduct monetary policy without political interference. "The legal actions were unprecedented in our 113-year history," Powell said. "I worry that these attacks are battering the institution." The January decision to pursue a Justice Department criminal investigation, in the view of people who know Powell well, reflected a fundamental misreading of the Fed chair, one they described as alarming, strategically inept, and ultimately revealing about the administration's intentions. Rather than push him out the door, the move reinforced Powell's sense of responsibility to the institution and helped produce the decision he had hoped to avoid. The probe wasn't the only concern. Talk among the president's allies about firing Reserve Bank presidents, who since 1935 have served as a structural check on White House influence over monetary policy, deepened the worry. The tactics might change, the thinking went, but the goal wouldn't. Seizing control of the Fed's decentralized rate-setting committee outside of the legally established appointment process in which a board seat opens every 2 years. What the probe signaled about Trump's willingness to pursue those aims, these people said, was the reason that staying was on the table at all. Without it, Powell wouldn't have seriously considered remaining once Trump nominated former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh to succeed him as chair. Powell's decision drew swift criticism from Trump allies. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent called it a violation of all Federal Reserve norms and said Powell was acting as if he alone can maintain the integrity of the Fed, adding that it was insulting to Warsh. Larry Kudlow, the former Trump economic advisor who used to meet with the Fed leader, said the decision reflected poorly on Powell. "Jay Powell's not the martyr he thinks he is," Kudlow said on his Fox Business program. "He has bad manners." Trump said Thursday that he wasn't bothered by Powell's decision. "I don't care," he told reporters. Powell said he wasn't staying to second-guess Warsh and that he would keep a low profile. "I'm not looking to be a high-profile dissident or anything like that," he said. The pressure had been building for months. Verbal criticism from the White House turned a legal confrontation in August when the Trump administration sought to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook in a case she challenged. It is now pending at the Supreme Court. Then in January, the Justice Department opened a criminal investigation of Powell's oversight of building renovations. Powell challenged the effort in a behind-closed-doors legal battle, and a federal judge ruled the subpoenas improper. Lawmakers in both parties called the matter unworthy of criminal scrutiny. The blowback froze Warsh's path through the Senate until April 24, when the U.S. Attorney's Office announced the probe would be halted, just in time for the Senate to confirm Warsh on schedule. Current and former Fed officials who have been appointed by presidents from both parties said they hoped they would have made the same decision Powell made if they had been in his position. Jay was in a really difficult situation, said Loretta Mester, who, as president of the Cleveland Fed from 2014 to 2024, served alongside Powell for a decade. I think he did what he had to do, given the conditions. The probe was resolved in a way that satisfied the key Senate Republican, Tom Tillis of North Carolina. With his one-man blockade ended, Warsh's confirmation advanced through the Senate Banking Committee on a party-line vote last week. Hours later, Powell said the resolution hadn't met the standard he had publicly set weeks earlier when he said it needed to end with transparency and finality. The Justice Department offered private assurances that it would pursue a criminal referral only if the Fed's Inspector General, whose audit Powell had requested last July, found wrongdoing. The department also indicated that its forthcoming appeal of the subpoena ruling was about preventing adverse case law for the government, not about reopening the probe against him. But the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't issue a public exoneration, and officials suggest they could restart the investigation at any time. Powell hasn't said how long he plans to stay. His term as a governor ends in early 2028. Some of those who know him say he could be there a while because they have concluded the administration can't be trusted to change its behavior. Given that Powell is looking for credible assurances from an administration that has shown repeatedly that it cannot be trusted to restrain its vindictive urges, I suspect Powell's tenure may continue for a considerable period, said John Faust, who was a senior advisor to Powell from 2018 to 2024. Staying carries its own risk for the institution Powell is trying to defend. Every vote he casts as a governor will be parsed for political meaning. Powell's mere presence gives the administration a target it wouldn't otherwise have and complicates Warsh's task of taking command of an institution his predecessor had run for 8 years. Warsh has laid out an ambitious agenda for the Fed that promises a rethink of how the Fed operates, manages its relationship with the Treasury Department, and communicates with the public. Even without giving speeches or interviews, Powell will introduce an unfamiliar dynamic by sitting in the room as those debates unfold. He doesn't want to be viewed as someone who is obstructing a new chair who's coming in, said Mester, the former Cleveland Fed president. And if he was ever in a position where he felt like he had to dissent, then that's going to be even more scrutiny. Oh, the Fed's acting political. That Powell is willing to bear those costs reflects both on how he reads the threat and how he reads his obligations, said former Philadelphia Fed president Patrick Harker. He is doing what he has done from the start. He is absorbing pressure that the institution would otherwise have to absorb without him, he wrote in an essay Saturday. He had every right to retire, Harker added. He earned it. He chose not to. On Wednesday, Powell said he wants to see more than just a resolution of the legal cases. He wants a return to a calmer relationship between the Fed and the executive branch. The Fed hadn't lost the ability to make its decisions free of politics, Powell said, but we've had to fight for it. He added, I'd like to think we can get out of that era and go back to respecting what the law says and what custom has been, what is to let the Fed do our thing. World, Europe. Germany and Europe have bigger Trump problems than U.S. troop withdrawal. The transatlantic relationship is eroding faster than the continent is rearming. By Bertrand Benoit and Danielle Michaels. German officials shrugged off President Trump's decision to withdraw 5,000 U.S. troops from the country as symbolic, but analysts warned the broader transatlantic rift risks leaving Europe's economy and security dangerously exposed. Trump's latest increase in tariffs on European cars, his apparent U-turn on plans to station long-range missiles in Germany, and the economic and military fallout from the war in Iran will have a bigger impact on the region, they warned. All of these are a bigger deal than a symbolic 5K troop reduction, said Thorsten Benner, director of the Global Public Policy Institute, a Berlin security think tank. So is the rapid depletion of the U.S. arsenals due to wasting enormous amounts of precious assets in the Iran war. Senior U.S. defense officials said Friday the Pentagon would withdraw an army brigade from Germany within 6 to 12 months, days after German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said the U.S. didn't seem to have an exit strategy in Iran, and described Tehran as humiliating America in negotiations. Merz sought to lower the temperature on Sunday, telling public broadcaster ARD in an interview, "I have to accept that the American president has a different view on these issues than we do, but that does not change the fact that I'm still convinced that the Americans are important partners for us." A senior U.S. official said Saturday that Trump, U.S. adversaries in the world were watching what European nations like Germany do, including in the Middle East, adding that their actions and words matter to the president. Germany is the nerve center of the 85,000-strong U.S. troop presence in Europe, where a dense network of bases helps Washington project power across the world. The vast Ramstein Air Base in southern Germany has been a key logistics hub for U.S. military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and this year, Iran. The announced withdrawal would represent about 14% of the roughly 36,000 troops currently in the country, not much more than the normal fluctuation and much smaller than the 12,000 reduction Trump tried to implement in his first term. Most of these troops serve U.S. military operations around the world and aren't there to protect Germany in case of an attack. It was foreseeable that the U.S. would withdraw troops from Europe, including Germany, German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said Saturday, adding that Europe was already investing to fill the gap. "Germany is on the right track," he said. Germany and allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization are working with the U.S. to understand the details of their decision on force posture in Germany, said the NATO media service on X. The military alliance said the move underscores the need for Europe to continue to invest more in defense and take on a greater share of the responsibility for our shared security, but NATO can still provide for our deterrence and defense. A bigger concern is the news that the U.S. has decided not to deploy a battalion to operate Tomahawk cruise missiles and Dark Eagle hypersonic missiles in Germany, a deal struck in 2024 by the Biden administration in an effort to deter Russia from an attack on NATO after its invasion of Ukraine 2 years earlier. Officials in Berlin had anticipated that the Trump administration wouldn't honor the deal, having never committed to do so, said Nico Lang, director of Germany's Institute for Risk Analysis and International Security and a former senior German Defense Ministry official. Still, the fact that now, when we're facing such a serious threat level in Europe, this conventional deterrence gap isn't being closed, that is a real problem, said Lang. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on with our story. We have troops of our own, but no one in Europe possesses this specific capability yet. In Washington, members of Congress from both parties criticized the announcement as potentially hurting U.S. interests. Based on congressional reaction, the announcements have not been fully coordinated and will have an impact on NATO deterrence, said retired U.S. Army Major General Gordon Davis, a former senior NATO official. The U.S.'s ability to respond rapidly to potential conflict in Europe or adjacent regions would also be affected, he added. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk said Saturday the greatest threat to the transatlantic community are not its external enemies, but the ongoing disintegration of our alliance. In a post on X, Tusk, a former president of the European Council, wrote, "We must all do what it takes to reverse this disastrous trend." Another reason to worry, withholding the battalions is the latest signal of a détente between the Trump administration and Russian President Vladimir Putin. It follows the suspension of oil sanctions against Russia after Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz. European leaders think the moves are undermining efforts to reach a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia. Under Merz's government, Germany has been ramping up military spending and speeding up procurement with the goal of becoming Europe's largest conventional military force by 2029. It has also entered an agreement with France to supplement the U.S. nuclear umbrella. Military analysts said Berlin was well on the way to becoming less dependent on America's military protection, but that the Merz-Trump spat was a useful reminder of the urgency of this effort. Yet the rapid depletion of the U.S. arsenal during its offensive on Iran has created a dilemma for Europe, whose rearmament remains slow and dependent on purchases from America, particularly in crucial areas such as anti-aircraft systems and long-range missiles. All of this translates into a heightened security risk for Europe, said Lang. Economic headwinds from an array of Trump policies that have undermined Germany's ability to support its huge defense investments are a big worry. German exports to the U.S., a crucial lifeline to offset a long-term loss of market share in China, have collapsed since Trump started a trade war with Europe last year. An EU-US trade deal agreed last summer has offered little relief to many German manufacturers because separate US steel and aluminum tariffs have hit their products. Government officials and economists had hoped that Berlin's defense splurge and a separate public infrastructure investment offensive would bolster growth this year, but a sharp uptick in energy prices following an attack on Iran shattered those expectations. The government has since slashed its sputtering growth forecast for this year, and business confidence hit a six-year low this month. Trump's announcement that he was raising tariffs on European cars from 15% to 25% this week will add to the burden for Germany's long-suffering flagship industry. Germany's continuing economic malaise is also sapping Merz's political margin of maneuver at home. After a gradual collapse in ratings since he came to office last year, the chancellor has become one of the least popular in post-war history. Politics, policy. The anti-abortion movement is turning on Trump. The ubiquity of abortion pills during the second Trump administration has frustrated anti-abortion advocates. By Philip Wegman, Liz Esley White, and Jennifer Kalfas. The anti-abortion lobby expected to be more triumphant by now. A conservative Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Republican controls both chambers of Congress, and the self-styled most pro-life president in history again occupies the Oval Office. But abortions are up in the years after the overturning of Roe, and the anti-abortion lobby has a new locus for blame. Trump is the problem. The president is the problem. Marjorie Denzfelser, the influential president of Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, "The ubiquity of abortion pills during the second Trump administration has led anti-abortion advocates to decry the president's appointees, including Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Marty Maurice, and promise cash and political firepower to politicians who oppose the drugs." Denzfelser's assessment for supporters packed into a glitzy neoclassical auditorium in downtown Washington for the group's spring gala Wednesday was dire. If Republicans don't abandon Trump's strategy of letting states decide abortion law, then the movement as we know it is finished. Now, Denzfelser's group is preparing to spend $160 million in the coming midterms and the 2028 presidential primary. The hurdle for candidates looking to tap into that support, they must commit, Denzfelser said, to pro-life action at the national level. Leaders in the anti-abortion movement are quick to credit Trump for nominating the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe, but their frustration has been building for months. They hoped that the administration would roll back Biden-era rules allowing the abortion pill, mifepristone, to be prescribed online and shipped through the mail. The regulations have allowed clinicians in states with liberal abortion laws, such as New York, to prescribe and send pills to women in states with strict abortion bans, such as Mississippi. The Food and Drug Administration has instead left those rules intact. Under McCary's leadership, the drug approved a new generic version of the drug last fall and has yet to produce a promised safety study on the pill. The Justice Department, meanwhile, has asked courts to pause or completely dismiss lawsuits from Republican state attorneys general over access to mifepristone. "This is just insulting, right? This is not what we voted for," said Mark Wheat, general counsel for Advancing American Freedom, an organization founded by former Vice President Mike Pence. Tony Perkins, president of the Conservative Family Research Council, called the situation unprecedented. "You have Republican states that are challenging a Republican administration over this because their laws are being undermined," Perkins said. Pro-life voters are going to be wondering what's going on when they head to the polls in November. A federal appeals court on Friday blocked doctors from mailing mifepristone to pregnant women without seeing the patient in person, ruling in favor of Louisiana. The decision marked a significant win for anti-abortion groups and sparked outcry from supporters of abortion rights. The Trump administration had asked a federal court earlier this year to block Louisiana's challenge. After the ruling, Denzfelser said, "It's shameful that the Trump administration's inaction has forced pro-life states to take their battle to the federal courts." Asked about criticism from anti-abortion advocates, White House spokeswoman Allison Schuster said, "Since his first term, the president has been a proven leader in the pro-life movement, and he will continue to champion these policies to protect the sanctity of life." Calling Trump the most pro-life and pro-family president in history, Schuster said the FDA is conducting a review of mifepristone in response to what she called widespread concerns about the drug. SBA called for McCray to be fired last December following reports that the commissioner was slow-walking the safety review of the abortion pill. Later that same month, Pence called on Trump to take an additional step and fire Kennedy, calling him a progressive wolf in pro-life sheep's clothing. It's very clear that the issue is perceived as the third rail, and you just have to stay away from it, Dannon Feltzer said of how she believes the White House handles the topic. You cannot utter the A word. For months, the administration said the new safety study was coming, and Merrick McCary has said publicly that his agency is working on the data acquisition needed to finish the review. But privately, the FDA commissioner has told others in the administration that he can't produce the study until a new drug safety data monitoring system known as Sentinel 3.0 is up and running, people familiar with the matter said. McCary has argued current systems are inadequate to the task, a claim some FDA staff dispute. The FDA hasn't yet finished the lengthy process of finding a contractor to run the new system, which might not be ready to use until late 2026 or even 2027, some of the people said. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican Louisiana, an SBA favorite who had been criticized by Trump, said a review is necessary because he worries easy-to-access abortion pills have led women to taking them in later stages of pregnancy, resulting in more dangerous complications such as hemorrhage. He is also worried about women being coerced into taking the pills by boyfriends or others. The FDA says on its website that the drug, approved by more than 20 years ago, is safe when used as indicated. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon said the FDA awarded a contract for the mifepristone study and is close to selecting a contractor for the Sentinel 3 system, which is on track to be operational by the end of this fiscal year. Some in the anti-abortion movement, including SBA, have accused the Trump administration of dragging its feet on the review to avoid political controversy before the midterms, an allegation that both the White House and the FDA deny. McCary's delays on Sentinel, according to people familiar with the situation, have frustrated health officials, including Kennedy, who wants the system to review both mifepristone and other drugs, vaccines, and chronic health issues. McCary had already surprised some top administration officials with his decision to approve a generic version of the abortion pill last fall, according to people familiar with the matter. The FDA only approved a second generic mifepristone tablet because federal law requires approval when an application proves the generic is identical to the brand name drug, HHS's Nixon said. McCary told the Journal last year that the administration could have slow-walked the approval. There are ways we could have subverted, we could have drug our feet, he said in October, voicing indifference to policy around the abortion pill. I don't think about the abortion pill or its safety restrictions, McCary said. While Trump campaigned explicitly on an anti-abortion message the first time he sought the GOP nomination, he has subsequently held the issue at arm's length, saying he favors states deciding their own policies. Dannon Feltzer called Trump immediately after he announced during the 2024 campaign that he would leave the issue to the states. The message from the then-former president, she recalled, was that a hard line on abortion, specifically federal restrictions, would cost Republicans with voters. It's killing us, she recalled him saying. Dannon Feltzer tried calling Trump earlier this year after he called for flexibility on the Hyde Amendment banning federal funds for abortion. She said she was sent to voicemail. And on to our next story. Health, wellness, don't get too comfortable, your quality of life depends on it. Research shows that vitality is improved by challenging avoidance, stasis, and soothing habits, and instead leaning into uncertainty and discomfort, by Moshe Bar. We've built a world that can numb discomfort instantly, and we're surprised we feel less alive. As artificial intelligence makes life frictionless, we risk removing the very frictions that keep human beings healthy. Effort, challenge, learning, and forward motion. The next public health crisis may be stagnation, not stress. The fix isn't another pleasure, it's progression. Progression is not simply about moving forward, nor is it about constant achievement or relentless productivity. It is about adaptation, the way a muscle grows stronger when challenged, or a mind becomes more flexible when it explores. Progression is engaging in challenges that expand our future capacity, physically, behaviorally, and mentally. When we do this consistently, as research conducted in my own labs, as well as many others, shows, we improve mood, strengthen resilience, enhance health, and slow many processes associated with aging. Humans thrive when they grow. This matters biologically. Sustained engagement with manageable challenge produces a condition scientists call vitality, a functional state in which the body and brain become more resilient and flexible, and stress regulation and brain plasticity systems operate efficiently and in coordination. People in this state show greater long-term health. Over time, vitality influences many of the biological processes that drive aging and age-related diseases, including chronic inflammation and loss of cellular repair efficiency. Today, 6 in 10 young adults, 8 in 10 midlife, and 9 in 10 older U.S. adults report one or more chronic diseases, according to analysis from the CDC. Roughly half have two or more. Progressively active, engaged lifestyles help regulate many of these disease processes. The result is not necessarily a longer maximum lifespan, but a slower decline and a lower disease risk, what researchers increasingly call better health span. Progression shows up in three everyday domains. Move your body forward, boost your life. The most familiar form of progression is physical. Aerobic exercise improves mood, cognition, and cardiovascular health while reducing inflammation and stress. But the benefits do not come from movement alone. They emerge when effort gradually increases, when endurance, strength, or skill expand over time in what is called progressive overload. The body adapts to challenge, building capacity that remain after the workout ends. Advance with small actions, gain big momentum. Progression also operates in daily behavior. In clinical psychology, a treatment known as behavioral activation helps people recover from depression by re-engaging with meaningful activities instead of withdrawing. Even small actions, a walk around the block, calling a friend, finishing a task, can interrupt cycles of avoidance and restore momentum. Mood often improves after action begins, not before. Merely setting a goal is not enough, and simply increasing activity volume is not enough either. Forward movement itself is the ingredient that rekindles energy and a sense of agency. Explore uncertainty, improve your mood. Thoughts can progress as well. The mind can become trapped in narrow loops of worry and rumination, or it can move outward, forming new associations and imagining multiple future possibilities. Our own research shows that when thinking is broad and exploratory, taking novel and uncertain mental paths, it can improve mood, cognitive flexibility, and creativity. Thinking that it is instead repetitive and narrow, like circling in our mind around that tactless comment from last night, or all the possible ways an upcoming trip can go wrong, is linked to depression, anxiety, and diminished vitality. When thoughts move forward, it recruits the brain systems involved in learning, motivation, and future planning, and this forward engagement helps energize the very psychological systems that support resilience and well-being. Nature, in its ingenuity, built an incentive system to guide us toward these benefits. Behavior that promote progression often improve mood and well-being, nudging us to continue. Yet reward alone is not enough. Many pleasurable habits, from scrolling and sugar to alcohol and passive entertainment, can temporarily elevate mood without building capacity. They soothe without strengthening. Progression is different. It may involve effort, uncertainty, and discomfort, but it leaves us more capable than before. This distinction may help explain why achieving a goal produces only fleeting satisfaction, while sustained engagement in challenging pursuits predicts longer-lasting well-being and reduces mortality risk. The key is not the reward at the finish line, it is the accumulation of forward movement along the way. In an era marked by burnout, sedentary lifestyles, and rising mental health struggles, progression offers a practical compass. We do not need to overhaul our lives overnight. Progression begins with manageable challenges. In practice, this can be simple: walking a little farther than usual, returning to one avoided activity before you feel ready, or allowing the mind to move beyond its usual loops by exploring a new idea or perspective. The question should not be, does this feel good right now, but does this move me forward? When we move forward in body, behavior, and thought, vitality follows. And over time, vitality protects what matters most, our capacity to adapt, endure, and remain fully alive. Algorithms optimize for efficiencies. Human beings are optimized by effort. Moshe Bar is a neuroscience professor at Bar Ilan Hospital and at Massachusetts General Hospital, the author of Mind Wandering: How Your Constant Mental Drift Can Improve Your Mood and Boost Your Creativity. He formerly served as the director of the Multidisciplinary Center for Brain Research at Bar Ilan University. Policy. He rescued Trump from one assassination attempt. Now he has to answer for another. Sean Curran earned the president's trust but faces questions on whether he can implement necessary changes. By C. Ryan Barber, Annie Linsky, and Maggie Severns. Sean Curran cut the storybook image of a Secret Service agent when, in a dark suit and sunglasses, he whisked Donald Trump away from an attempt on his life in Butler, Pennsylvania, in July 2024. About 2 years later, another would-be assassin targeted Trump, and Curran is the one answering for the agency as questions about its preparedness mount. The gunman last month at a Washington press dinner marked the third direct assassination attempt against Trump in less than 2 years, prompting lawmakers and others to ask whether the Secret Service had sufficiently learned the security lessons from the past attempts. In 2024, Curran was head of Trump's security detail. Now he is head of the entire Secret Service. A week after the shooting, authorities hadn't yet clearly explained what happened that night. Several videos have compounded the confusion, including one made public Thursday that appeared to show a security dog identifying the suspect, only to have the dog handler ignore the warning. Some law enforcement officials have also privately questioned how the Federal Bureau of Investigation Inquiry is being handled and why officials seem to be struggling to provide the public with basic facts, according to people familiar with the concerns. An FBI representative said the Bureau had provided information to the public at lightning speed. Appearing on Fox News, Curran said all the evidence he had seen shows that the suspect shot a Secret Service officer with a shotgun before being apprehended. Our officer heroically returned fire while being shot point-blank range in the chest with the shotgun and was able to get off 5 shots, said Curran, who also went to Capitol Hill to brief members of Congress. Trump appointed Curran to run the Secret Service last year, choosing a longtime field officer who has spent little time dealing with Washington politics and bureaucracy, but had promised to do anything to protect Trump. He leapfrogged several higher-ranking Secret Service officials to take the job. The president had developed a strong bond with Curran during the in-between years, when Trump was out of power, according to people familiar with the matter. Curran's brawling with headquarters for more protection at that time was noted and appreciated by Trump. And when an assassin's bullet grazed his ear in Butler, Pennsylvania, the president's view was cemented, the people said. Kern was one of the few people he could trust in an agency that had failed to protect him. Last week, federal prosecutors charged the 31-year-old suspect, Cole Thomas Allen, with attempted assassination, alleging that he rushed through a Secret Service checkpoint with a shotgun and pistol before being stopped outside the Washington Hilton Ballroom. There's always room for improvement, right? Trump said Thursday in the Oval Office when asked about the Secret Service. He got into the building, White House spokesman Davis Engel said. The president continues to have confidence in all his top law enforcement personnel, including Curran. Some former law enforcement officials said the process functioned as intended, given that the gunman didn't make it into the dinner itself. The Secret Service layers of protection are meant to act as tripwires to catch people, said retired Secret Service agent Donald Michalek. In this case, it caught somebody. It worked. Past independent panels have recommended that the agency appoint a director with significant outside experience. And another former law enforcement official said Curran might be too loyal to the agency to implement the shakeup that it needed. So tight is their trust that one White House official recalled talking to the president about an event, and Trump joked that he would attend only if Curran approved of it. The head of the detail and the protectee always have an intimate relationship, said Ron Layton, a former top secret official. You'll see that person more than you see your own family, Layton said. Sean really told him, whatever it is, whatever happens, wherever you go, I'll be there with you. Curran joined the Secret Service in 2001. He served as a top agent on Trump's detail during the first presidential term and took over his protection in 2021. The role put him near daily contact with Trump during a presidency dominated by court hearings for prosecutions in New York, Washington, Atlanta, and South Florida in between the campaigns. Trump also then faced threats from Iran and an errant private drone that aides believe could have been from Tehran prompted discussion about pulling him from an event at his golf course in Los Angeles, according to a former Trump aide who was there. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programming on Sun Sounds.